Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, the Chupacabra, UFOs, aliens, Area 51, conspiracies, unsolved crimes, the supernatural. Are they real or are they figments? With your hosts, Colleen and Eddie Medina.
Hello and welcome to Figments, a podcast where we talk about the unknown and the unexplained. I'm Eddie Medina, your co-host, and with me is the lovely Colleen Medina.
Hey guys, how's everybody doing? How's it going?
And we're here live at GeekyCon 2014.
Woohoo!
And we have a special guest tonight, Mr. Lyle Blackburn. Lyle Blackburn is an author of two books, The Beast of Boggy Creek and The Lizard Man, The True Story of the Bishopville Monster. Lyle is a familiar face to several TV shows dealing with cryptozoology and the sort, but we're going to let him get into the specifics of that. He's also a musician and a very well-accomplished musician, known the world over, you might say. But Lyle, thank you for joining us today, and why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started in cryptozoology?
Well, it's just something I was always interested in as a kid. You know, I saw a lot of documentaries on TV about Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, read books, and so, you know, it was something that was sort of a hobby for a while, and, you know, I was always attracted to monsters, you know, horror movies and things, but when it came to... Yep. Bigfoot and things that I thought could actually be real, it kind of creeped me out more, and so I think I was more attracted to that. So
yeah.
Growing up, you know, at first I had the impression that Bigfoot lived in the Pacific Northwest. You know, of course, Loch Ness Monster is associated with Scotland and things like that, so it was always tales that were so distant, but sometime in the late 70s, I saw a movie called The Legend of Boggy Creek, which dramatized alleged true life encounters with a Bigfoot-like creature in southern Arkansas. So that was certainly closer to home, and that movie kind of solidified my interest in this. So fast forward several years, I spent many years as a musician and, you know, on the road, but I'd always wanted to write some books, and when I finally started writing books, I picked the subject that I'd always loved, and that was, you know, cryptids and cryptozoology.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
My first book, The Beast of Boggy Creek, was about the history behind the legend of Boggy Creek,
mm-hmm.
and that sort of just snowballed into television and more books from there.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great movie. Would you say that Bigfoot is your favorite cryptid?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. You know, it's the one that's certainly one of the most iconic of cryptids, and
mm-hmm.
oh yeah,
and, you know, always kind of the first one I can recall. And I saw the old Patterson-Gimlin film
mm-hmm.
on television, the famous Bigfoot film. So, you know, once I'd seen that, it was pretty much my main monster, so to speak.
Would you say the Lizard Man is your second favorite?
Well, it is now since I wrote a book about him. So yeah, but, I mean, to me, the case with lizard men or real-life reports of reptilian humanoids, in particular mm-hmm. a famous case, the Bishopville lizard man, it's almost like a real-life creature from the Black Lagoon. And that
yeah.
really attracted me because it's one of mm-hmm. my favorite old
oh, yeah.
horror movies.
Oh, uh-huh. Right there with you.
This was almost like investigating you know, real-life sightings of people saying they saw something akin to a creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah.
Can you remember the first time you actually went out on a Bigfoot hunt? Like, you actually went out into scariness, darkness. Do you remember how old you were, who you were with, where you were?
Well, I mean, it wasn't, you know, when I was a kid, I didn't really do anything back then. So it's mm-hmm. been more recent when I've actually gone with the intent and purpose
mm-hmm.
to do research. But I my father is an avid bow hunter, so I grew up
oh, cool.
basically in the woods as far back as when I could walk, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, but at those times I just didn't realize there was sighting reports so much of creatures nearby. But I did a lot of camping and hunting in Texas and Arkansas and around there, so I was in the woods quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, in recent times, I've actually gone out you know, with the intent of research of cryptids. So I was very familiar with the woods and sort of, you know, not scared of being in the woods,
right,
in the dark and in remote places. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but it still has an allure to it, mm-hmm, even though I have that experience.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Have you had any actual sightings, heard anything? Have you seen any footprints? Have you made any casts, anything like that?
I've never had an actual sighting myself. I've seen a few things that you may could interpret as footprints, but I'm pretty, mm-hmm, picky when it comes to that.
Yeah, that's exactly how
we are.
Yeah,
we are too.
I mean, you know, there's a lot of, you know, blobby footprints that have been cast. So there's no real reason to add to that unless I really think it's solid.
Yeah.
But I have heard some strange things. We were, a friend of mine, myself, were canoeing in a bayou in southern Arkansas in the Sulphur River bottomlands. And it was pretty late at night, and we heard a very distinctive howl, one that I couldn't dismiss as a coyote or an owl or some, mm-hmm, of the usual suspects. I mean, even birds make bizarre noises.
Oh,
so
yeah.
You have to be,
uh-huh,
very familiar with what may be out there. And this was one that we could not determine to be anything that we could identify. And it was probably 2 a.m. in the morning when we first heard the howl. And at first, you know, we were moving in a canoe, so you try to stop. What was that? You know? Well, luckily, it did it again. And it was the very same howl. And in about 45 seconds, it did it a third time.
Ooh.
So now
we
can really focus in, listen, and say, okay, that definitely wasn't a coyote.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, kind of spooked us out a little bit. We listened for a while, didn't make any more sounds. We're like, oh, man. So it sounded like it was probably a quarter mile off. I mean, it was a pretty good distance.
Yeah.
So we hung around for a while, and then we headed back down the bayou back to our camp, which was a pretty good distance. It took us about another, I don't know, 30, 45 minutes. As soon as we got out of the water, got up into camp, we heard the howl again. But this time, it was literally right across the bayou channel. I mean, it was too
much. Oh, my God.
Oh, wow.
That is
within
creepy.
100 yards, which, you know, seemingly the creature had followed us all along. And so that was kind of spooky. And it did it 3 more times consecutively. Same thing.
That is wild.
Same thing. So that, you know.
Did you happen to record it?
I did.
Oh, you did?
I did, actually.
Wow.
Unfortunately, it's tough to get a good recording in those conditions because, you know, it's at a distance, and as well, the insects are so loud that I didn't have a very good, you know, parabolic mic. You know, I should probably have that. You never have the stuff when you really need it.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Exactly.
And we're standing up in camp. I just luckily had grabbed my recorder and recorded it. So, it's hard to hear. You get a lot of, you can hear the ambient sounds of the insects louder, really, than the howl.
That's really neat that it did it multiple times, because a lot of times we've heard stories from other people where they hear a howl or a growl, something that, you know, they don't recognize from, you know, the natural world. And more often than not, what we've heard in stories is that you hear one or two, and that's probably all the chances you get. But it's pretty cool that you actually heard multiple howls going, you know, along down with you.
Yeah, yeah. I felt pretty fortunate because a lot of times you hear one, you know, which you're not able to concentrate on, and you're lucky if you get a second one.
That's
so
true.
We heard 6 altogether.
Wow.
And that was one of the odd things, is the spacing of it and, you know, how clear the thing was, as opposed to coyotes that do a lot of yelping, and it's kind of more random, or, you know, certainly you can distinguish owls, but this was certainly something. And we listened to all kinds of animal recordings after that and never could find anything that matched, so we're still not sure.
Have you had any experts listen to it to see what they think?
I had a few friends, you know, which are longtime researchers, and yeah, I mean, everybody, unfortunately, just the howl didn't translate.
Yeah, yeah.
What we heard as to what gets on the recorder, so, but they've listened to it, and nobody could pinpoint anything either, so it's just unknown.
See, and that's the thing, you said you've, since being young, you would go out bow hunting, so I'm sure you're more than familiar with the sounds of the woods, the different animals, and so this
yeah
completely different.
Yeah, and you had myself and my partner Tom. He grew up as a trapper in Mississippi.
Okay.
So that dude's been in the woods as long as I have. So
yeah.
It's good to have somebody, a little counsel there, to say, I don't think that was a coyote, or I don't think, and if, you know, he's like, no, it definitely wasn't. So it kind of backs it up, because your mind, you know, will later on, you're trying to think, well, maybe it was, or
yeah,
you're
exactly
going the other direction and say, oh, it definitely was. But you've got somebody to back you up, so that kind of made it more credible.
Did you notice any smells, or did you hear anything rustling around? Because I know whenever you said that whenever y'all moved, it seemed like it was a little bit closer.
Yeah, it definitely got closer. We couldn't hear it, though, because we were paddling in the canoe. I mean, we're fairly quiet, but it's duckweed scraping on the bottom of the canoe, and we just didn't hear it move at all until, you know, we didn't know its presence until it howled again when we were back there. So, and we never heard it run or anything else, so, and smelled no smells.
So it was just probably standing there staring at you.
It could have. I mean, it could have come up. I mean, it's creepy, you know, so.
Yeah.
And it's hard to see. I mean, this particular bayou is a channel. It's kind of a winding, snaky channel. You know, a lot of bayous you just picture is just kind of wide open. This definitely has a channel to it, so you can travel up and down. So it's like a waterway, more like a river.
Yeah.
In some ways, but it's got the cypress trees. I mean, it is your quintessential swamp. It is spooky. It looks like something out of, you know, Scooby-Doo, you know, when they go to the swamp. I mean, this is the swamp they modeled that after, you know, or countless horror movies. So, I mean, the setting is perfect, and it, you know, it's always fun and a thrill to get out there.
And that was at night?
You said like 2 in the morning?
About 2 a.m.
Yeah. So the next day, the next morning, where were you? Were you kind of in the same location, or?
Yeah, we camped right there where we pulled the boats out. We were camping right there. Mm-hmm. So
did you happen to go look for any footprints or anything?
We looked around, but we, you know, we couldn't really pinpoint very well where it was.
Okay. And,
but we did hike up and down there in that area. It had rained a few days earlier, and we did look for footprints for about a mile up and down some open area.
Yeah.
With a lot of hog prints, but
yeah,
that's all we found.
What do you think about this, since we're talking about these creatures that live in the those areas? Do you think there's enough fruit to sustain several families of Bigfoots? Or, you know, there's what naysayers like to say is there's not enough food out there to sustain these large animals, and definitely not if you have multiples, ones that are, you know, enough to reproduce and carry on the lineage. Do you think that's not the case? I mean, because you're out there, with wild hogs, vegetation, do you feel like there's enough food to sustain them?
Yeah, I think there would be. I mean, in most of these places, there has been sightings of black bears. I mean, they're not very prominent these days, but black bears have been known to exist in these habitats.
Yeah.
And they're certainly large creatures, and if they can do it, you know, other large creatures can. But, I mean, you know, something like a Bigfoot, it would need to be an omnivore. It would be opportunistic on its feeding, so it would have to eat just whatever. And there's a lot of stuff, especially in these swamps. I mean, and if you want to count, you know, the free meal on four legs known as a feral hog, I mean, we've seen so many hogs out there.
Yeah.
So,
oh, yeah, definitely.
And I have reports of, I had a couple who lived in a rural area near where we were at, and they said they had seen hogs coming through there. You know, they suspected that some Sasquatch were killing some. I have a report from a hunter who was out on the Sabine River in East Texas, who literally said he was sitting in his stand, and saw some hogs coming up where his corn was. And he was looking at his scope, and it was just getting dark. And so he looked over to the right, and he saw something else kind of creeping up behind him.
Uh-oh.
And it was, you know, it was furry, and he thought maybe, you know, was that a bear? I mean, or is that just a burly hog? Well, then he could finally make it out, and the thing stood up, and it was a big
thing. Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
And he said he watched it come in, and those hogs didn't smell it. It came right up to him, and within about 1 second, it jumped out, grabbed one hog, threw it against a tree, grabbed another, broke its neck, and the rest of the hogs scattered.
Oh, my gosh.
And the guy's
Hello.
Looking through it from his scope, And he's watching all this. Just now, by now, he's just chilled to the bone, obviously.
Right.
It's getting dark. And he's thinking, well, dude, I'm good. He hasn't seen me. He's going about his business with the
he
hogs.
He has a meal.
He's going to be full.
And he's sitting there looking. And that creature, the Bigfoot, turns, looks straight at him.
Oh, my gosh. I just got chills.
And then walks off into the woods.
Oh, no, man.
I just got chills.
Oh, no way. Oh, no way. Could you imagine making that walk back after the fact?
Yeah.
Knowing that thing is out there.
He said he stayed in the stand for about 45 minutes. He was brave enough to get down.
Oh, my gosh.
Gets back home, tells his dad what happened. So his dad's like, naturally, why didn't you shoot it? And the guy said, I couldn't. It looked too human.
You hear that a lot.
Yeah, you hear that a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
But why shoot it if it's not coming at you?
Well, I mean, certainly.
But people have their own opinion about that.
And if you miss, I mean, you know, you may be in bigger trouble.
You gotta tick it off, too.
And the other part of it is, we've talked about this before, is you can shoot it, maybe put it down. What makes you think there's not going to be others that you don't see? And, you know, all you're going to do is anger them.
And you're history.
Yeah. Exactly.
My good friend Eric Brown, he's a horror novelist that wrote a book, a series of books called Bigfoot War. And very thing, like they kill one and that's it, man.
You got to deal with everybody else.
Is that the concept of the book?
In fact, a movie's coming out. They've turned his book into a movie.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
In May, should hit theaters or wherever they, you know, it's going. So,
yeah,
it's cool. But it is literally that. You know, you make it shoot one, but you better watch out.
Right. That's interesting. So, and I know there's a lot of people that think big feet, I like to say big feet, are vegetarians. Well, that just, I mean, yeah, I'm sure there's vegetarian stuff out there for them to eat. But that just kind of proves right there that they're not. And something that big, I think, would need meat. I mean,
yeah, I think it'd have to. I mean, because... I mean, certainly mountain gorillas and can be herbivores, and
right.
But they're living in rainforest type areas.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
We're not over here, so it's, you know, you got dry spells, and you definitely would have to adapt to that environment. And there's you know, a lot of theories. They hunt deer and all this stuff. And
right, the deer
certainly seems to make sense, and you know, to support a small population of these.
Mm-hmm. And if they're constantly moving, and they would kind of have to adapt to their environment as well, don't you think?
Oh yeah. Sorry.
Because I mean, we've heard a lot about, you know, they don't stay in one place very often. They're just constantly on the go, especially. And I think that's a lot of times why so many people have such a hard time finding them. Those that are hunting for Bigfoot, searching for, because the big feet are always kind of one step ahead of them.
Do you feel that they're nomadic, or what do you think about that?
Well, they would have to have a range of movement. I mean, any large predatory animal does, you know, from mountain lions, you know, to bears, in order to support themselves. There's,
right.
You know, no luxury like us. We sit at the house, run down to the McDonald's, you know, or whatever, and stay in a tight spot. But they would have to move, and, you know, as the legend of Boggy Creek says, they always travel the creeks.
Yeah.
In waterways or some of the areas where there's prominent sightings. And so, yeah, I think they'd have to move around to a certain extent just to, you know, survive. And these are the times when they're going to be seen, you know, getting, you know, moving. You're going to have to cross a road. You're going to have to, you know, go near some properties.
Exactly.
Moving, because they would rarely be seen if they just stayed back in the remotest bottomlands or at the,
top
of a mountain. I mean, you just... There are not going to be as many sightings. So my logic, if you know, say these sightings are indeed true, then naturally it supports the movement of these creatures.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you saying they always, what does he say? He always sticks to the creek.
He always travels the creek.
Travels the creek. Yeah. I'm going to have to go home and watch that movie tonight. It's one of my all-time favorite movies, and I'm just itching to go home and watch it tonight.
Well, why don't we just talk a little bit about the Boggy Creek phenomenon, that for those who may not be familiar with the story beyond the movie, well, first off, how accurate is the movie itself to the real events, and how far does it expand from there? Because I know you said the reason why you got into the whole Boggy Creek thing and researching it was because you were obsessed with that movie like we are. but you started realizing there wasn't a whole lot more out there that wasn't just like recycled movie reviews of it itself. So like beyond the movie itself, what else is there that you could talk about?
Well, as far as the movie itself, and this is a movie that came out in 1972.
Yeah.
The genesis of that was basically in 1971, reports of a creature known as the Fountain Monster were surfacing in near a little town in southwest Arkansas called Fauk. And it was in the Texarkana Gazette, and it kind of brewed up local, you know, interest in this, and several people had had encounters with what was seemingly an aggressive creature.
Right.
But once all this kind of came out in the papers, some of the locals were like, hey, you know, there's been sightings down here for years down in the bottoms that really were never in the paper. Mm-hmm. So it seemed to be a long history of this creature. A local advertising guy by the name of Charles B. Pierce, who lived in Texarkana, was seeing the stories in the paper and thought, man, this would be a great movie. He was looking for the subject of either a documentary or a movie. So he went down there and literally just enlisted the help of the locals to reenact these sightings to tell his story. He couldn't afford, you know, to pay actors and things like that. So it gave the movie a very authentic feel.
Uh-huh.
It was very docudrama in approach, and it was extremely effective to the point where the movie was made for about $160,000, and it went on to make about $25 million in the 70s. And that's back in the 70s.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
That's like if we went and made a zombie movie tomorrow for $100,000 that we borrowed from your dad, and we made nowadays, I mean, whatever $25 million is equivalent. $100 million or whatever.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
That would be the equivalent of what this was. So, of course, a lot of people said, you know, how accurate is the movie? Is Charles Pierce, you know, making a lot of stuff up? But in my research, which I did extensive research for years into this, what you see in the movie is basically all based on real life reports. You know, of course, it's dramatized, and some, you know, the tension and effect is there in the movie. He does well to bring out the best in the sightings, but at the basis, they were accurate.
Yeah.
And as you know, people think, oh, that all happened in the 70s and that's it. But what I discovered is there's been sightings ever since, all the way until today. I
mean, really?
Some of the TV shows I've done lately, we've reenacted some of the current sightings.
Yeah.
So there's not only a long history that I could find going back to 1908, but it's a continuing story in which people still have sightings of the Fountain Monster in the area.
Wow. So this is something 106 years documented that we have of this thing.
Did you just do math?
I know.
I'm impressed. Wow. Well, I really like in the movie how they use the Crabtree family.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that part because I know there were a few actors, like I think the part at the end with the family that lives in the house, and then the guy goes, you know, gets kind of attacked by the Sasquatch and goes into shock. I believe they're actors. But I like how they use the Crabtree family, and it kind of shows them, and they tell just a little bit of their experiences. So I thought that was neat. Not only did they bring in actors, but they also had the real-life people in the movie as well.
Right. Yeah, it was pretty much in that ending climax scene is the only time he used, you know, actors, so to speak. And they were still kind of unknown people. They did a great job.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, prior to that, it was mostly real people, and the crab trees were prominent in that story because there have been some sightings by several of their kinfolk down in Jonesville back in the 60s, even back to the 50s. So,
oh, okay.
You know, and I know Smokey Crabtree, and he's been a great researcher ever since then, and he's it's a big part of the movie success to be given to Smokey because he was the one that took Charles Pierce down there in the bayous and got him all those great wildlife shots. I mean, Smokey took him out in his Piro, which is a handmade canoe, basically, and showed Charles where to shoot. So we owe a lot to Smokey for the visuals that we see in that movie. So
It's neat. That's really neat. That's one of my favorite parts is the emphasis on, especially, I believe the boy, it's Travis, and how he goes out alone. And it's just so cool how a young little man, you know, he's got his shotgun or his rifle with him, and he goes out there and he's not scared, and he has his little campfire and everything. He goes and visits his friend. I just really love that movie.
Oh, yeah. The last story in that movie where
the guy gets attacked and they take him to the hospital. What was the after story to that? Because the movie kind of, you know, ends shortly after. How did he recover? Was there a lot of media attention on that particular family after the fact? Or did it just kind of get forgotten?
Brushed under the covers?
I mean, did it take him a while to recover and all that?
Well, they moved out literally the next day.
Yeah.
Right.
It scared them so bad.
Yeah.
So they didn't wait around for any convalescing in that home. They were like, we're back to Oklahoma.
We're done.
We've had enough of Falk. And they'd only been there 2 weeks.
Yeah.
But really, that story itself, that was the first one that appeared in the paper when the Fords reported that. And the reason it got out is because they took Bobby Ford to the hospital because he was in shock.
Right.
So when the doctor saw this and said, he's been attacked by a 7-foot-tall hairy monster, you know? He called one of the news reporters and put him onto the story. So the next day, there was hundreds of cars down there near the near that house, which is on Highway 71, which used to connect Shreveport and Texarkana. So it was immediately a huge deal.
Wow.
So that was the incident that started the whole thing.
Yeah.
That's
what started it. We've got it in the paper now. Like I said, you know, once it became public knowledge, you know, people had seen the Crabtrees and all those folks had sightings down there earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it really wasn't until Bobby got in the hospital until anybody knew about it, and that's what brought it to the attention of Charles Pierce and really what ended up getting the movie made. So the Fords moved out of town very promptly, but there was other sightings within weeks. Like, that was on May the 1st, like, few weeks later, May the 24th, there was another sighting on June 13th. Some tracks were found, and these are all documented in the movie as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I've been to all these places. All places
oh, cool.
You see in the movie, I've been, even, there's only one house standing. I've been to that house. I've been, you know, the old hermit Herb Jones. Last weekend, I was up there. I've located where he used to live, and I was excavating remnants of his old shack.
Wow.
That's the old man that Travis goes down to see.
Wow, oh my God.
That's really cool.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm totally, if you want to talk about geek, I'm a biography geek. I mean, Travis was like my hero when I was a kid. You know, I was like, oh, that dude's awesome. You know,
he's by
himself, you know.
Yeah, he's going trapping before school with his shotgun rifle, whatever it is. I mean, that can't get much cooler than that, you know.
Exactly.
I'm like eating Lucky Charms before school that my mom poured, and Travis is trapping a couple of beavers.
Right.
I'm like, dude, and by himself on the bayou. So,
exactly.
I mean, he was a hero, and so I'm sort of a historian on that, and I do have a lot of relics and pieces from the movie. I own the original oil painting of the movie poster, The Legend of Boggy Creek.
Oh, wow.
Which
was painted by Ralph McQuarrie.
Was it really? I didn't know that. Oh, my gosh.
Ralph
McQuarrie.
People go,
he is Star Wars. He developed the whole look of Star Wars.
Oh, I thought his name sounded familiar.
Yeah. I mean, he's one that, you know, did all the pre-production stuff. Basically, it was because of him that gave Star Wars a leg up to be bought by a studio, because they were looking at his visuals and were just blown away by these landscapes and worlds that he painted.
Very cool.
I had no idea he did that.
Yeah, that's a McQuarrie. Most people don't know who McQuarrie is. I explained that the look of the Star Wars characters are based on his concepts. And
yeah.
That's what got it sold to 20th Century Fox. But yeah, I own the original oil paint.
Oh my gosh.
McQuarrie's first movie poster.
Was it really?
Painted.
Oh my gosh.
On my wall.
I'm ashamed, because I'm a big Star Wars fan. The other podcast I do is the Rancor Pit, which is a Star Wars podcast, and I didn't know that.
I should be ashamed.
That is amazing.
Now, I have a question. If Bigfoot has been sighted so many times, like you said, especially by the Crabtree family, were they just kind of used to seeing him around? If it didn't really come out until Bobby Ford got attacked and went to the hospital and everybody, oh my goodness, what's going on? Did all the local or some of the locals just kind of get used to, you know, yeah, that's Bigfoot, we don't bother him, he doesn't bother us? Or, you know, what's kind of the story with that?
Well, yeah, you certainly have some of that. I mean, a lot of it, though, is that people would see things and if they said something, people would laugh at them and stuff, so you didn't get a real good response if they reported seeing a 7-foot-tall hairy wild man or whatever.
Okay.
So people were kind of reluctant, and as well, you know, a lot of people didn't say a lot, and it wasn't until it kind of became more public knowledge they say, well, you know, I saw something down there back about 10 years ago, but I didn't want to say anything because, so, yeah.
And we've heard that. You know, I didn't want to say anything, and then whenever somebody else came out, I felt like, okay, I'm not ashamed or embarrassed.
Because that whole strength in numbers, well, they're saying it, now I feel a little bit more confident to come forward, too.
Not necessarily that they're making it up. It's just, you know, you feel like, okay, I can let it out now.
Yeah.
Right, and that's with the Crabtree, is that's kind of what happened. I mean, Lynn Crabtree, Smokey's middle son, had an encounter in 1965 near the lake on their property. He was out there squirrel hunting, and he kind of dozed off, and he heard some horses running over the ridge, and they ran into their lake, which was weird, and it kind of woke him up.
Yeah.
And wondering what horses seemed scared. He looked up, and about literally 40 feet away, he sees this thing standing there. It was what he described as a very hairy-looking man with hair hanging in its eyes. It was very feral. I mean, he didn't use the term Bigfoot, because back then, those guys down there, they didn't know the term Bigfoot. Wow. And he said it was frightening. He fired at this thing and took off running, ran back to the house. A lot of that was just kept among the locals. I mean, well, they weren't going to run to the newspaper, or anything.
Yeah.
So it was just something the locals knew, and, you know, and that was it until Bobby got to the hospital, and now it's all coming out, you know.
Bobby let the cat out of the bag with that one.
Or Bigfoot.
Or Bigfoot out of the bag. There we go.
Well, before we get any further, I'd like to touch a little bit on the Lizard Man, if you'd like to do that, because the Lizard Man, and this is not the same incident, you know, unlike you and Colleen, Bigfoot has always been to me just like the granddaddy of cryptozoology. I mean, I'm obsessed by Bigfoot. I have been ever since I was like 4 or 5 years old. But one of the other cryptids I was always interested in was the Lizard Man. I remember being in kindergarten and reading a book and reading this account about the Lizard Man. But then, as I was looking into your book further, I realized that your book is just about an incident that happened in South Carolina. So this is a completely different story that I'm not even aware of myself. I mean, so I kind of like to touch on that, and maybe you can give a little bit of the story about what the book's about.
Yeah, there's, you know, it's kind of a famous case among cryptozoology, the Bishopville Lizard Man, and this is started with an incident in 1988. The catalyst for that, sort of like in the case of Bobby Ford, was a guy, Christopher Davis, was traveling from home from work one evening late, about 2 a.m., and he had to cross through an area called Skateboar Swamp, which is just outside of Bishopville, South Carolina, and Bishopville's a very small town.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, got a flat tire out there.
Oh, gosh.
Had to pull over. I mean, you can't walk from there. It was about 7 miles to his house, so he had to change it. About the time he's putting the flat tire and the jack back in the trunk, he sees something coming at him over in the fennel grass, and there was just enough moonlight where he could make out the shape. And he sees it looks like maybe it's a man, but it looks a little bigger, bulkier. So, you know, obviously he's a little spooked by this, starts heading toward the door of his car. As the thing got closer, he could see that it appeared to be more reptilian, maybe scaly. He said it looked like greenish or brown, and altogether not a man, but more like a reptilian humanoid.
Oh,
he jumps
my.
In the car, cranks it up, and floors it. And this creature, you know, lunges, tries to get in the car, and he could see it had three fingers with long black fingernails, and it had red eyes. And,
oh, my God.
I'm getting chills.
Well, you know, he manages to get going on the road. Well, the thing runs, and it's fast enough to jump onto the car and crawl up on the top. And it's still trying to reach in and grab him. And he swerves a little bit, and eventually it falls off, and he races home. Through a series of events that happened, some cars were damaged and things, something got in the newspaper, which led Christopher Davis's father to think it was a good idea to take Christopher down to see the sheriff Sheriff Truesdale, which was the sheriff of Lee County at the time, and Chris Davis told him his story about this lizard man, and some other people had mentioned seeing something strange in the area, which kind of gave that strength. Well, Truesdale, he believed the kid's story. He wasn't quite sure if it was a lizard man or whatever, but he was quite certain that something happened to this kid, and he wasn't sure what it was. So it set off an investigation for several months into this lizard man. And within that time, in 1988, other people began reporting sightings of this.
Oh, wow.
And just like in Boggy Creek, some old-timers came up and said, hey,
yeah,
2 years ago, I saw some weird thing down in the swamp. I just didn't tell anybody. And so this all built up the case, and I was able to go to Bishopville and visit with Sheriff Truesdale, who has a huge file of police records, investigation documents. He's been there all along.
Wow.
And I was able to have access to that and
oh, cool.
interview some of the witnesses and, you know, go into Skateboard Swamp and do all that. So that's what turned into my Lizard Man book based on that case.
What is that swamp kind of, is it pretty scary too?
Yeah, it's what's termed as a black water swamp. It's very brackish. The water doesn't move much. It's kind of like a swamp with a channel as well. There is a main channel running through it. You would think it was a creek in some areas, mm-hmm. but if you travel down in there, it's bottomlands and watery, you know, a lot of strange things go on down there. Moonshiners have hidden out down there because it's so rugged and remote.
Yeah.
Sheriff Truesdale, even, there's a good part in my book where we talk about him chasing a moonshiner in which he fell into quicksand.
Uh-oh.
It was nearly the end, you know, so by all accounts, it's a rugged and dangerous place, you know.
Was he out there by himself whenever that happened?
He was there with another deputy police officer, and they had the heads up on a moonshine still, and they crept out there one morning real early, got up pretty close, and this old boy saw him and took off running. And Truesdale said, you know, I got a reputation, I don't let nobody get away,
I'll
chase him down. And so he took off after this guy, and as they were running through the swamp, suddenly the guy just literally disappeared. He realized he just fell into this, like, mucky, quicksand area.
Well,
the guy was moving so fast, he just sort of flipped up to the other side. Well, Truesdale couldn't slow down. He went right into the quicksand.
It was like Scooby-Doo, how they just kind of disappear every once in a while.
This is real life, and I mean, you know.
Wow.
You know, crazy stuff. So it's, I love those kind of stories. I mean, mm-hmm. this is a real investigator, man. This is a real small-town sheriff.
Yeah.
And, you know, he looked into the Lizard Man case with an open mind. I mean, again,
it's good.
He just felt like there was some incidents when he thought, well, you know, even if it's a hoax or whatever, it sounds like somebody's about to get hurt. And if I don't,
right.
if I don't look into it and something happens, people are going to say, why didn't you look
yeah.
into it? But if
it's
he looks
fault.
Into it, you know, it's a Lizard Man. But he's been on a lot of the television shows over the years. I mean, when they do a Lizard Man story, I mean, it's recently even been on Mysteries at the Museum, Monsters and Mysteries in America.
Uh-huh.
I mean,
oh, cool.
It's Destination Truth. It's on all those shows.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Sheriff Truesdale is on there. Now, since my book is written, they, you know, I get
oh, yeah.
in as well. But so it's still a fun subject and still a mystery. I mean, the whole thing is
yeah.
spooky and still no accounting for what those people were seeing down there.
Now, the one guy, I believe you said his name Chris?
Yes.
He was pretty much attacked. I mean, his pretty much his car.
Yeah.
But what about the other people that were saying that they were seeing the lizard man? Did they just see him? Did they just kind of get a glimpse of him? Did any of them have the same experience that he had or something similar?
Are you asking like if there were any previous violent accounts?
Right.
Okay.
Or was he the only one that violence was actually done to?
I mean, that was the most sensational of them. I mean, when the thing
okay.
was so aggressive. The other reports fell into the, you know, it was seen running across the road. There was a guy who was riding his bike down in Skateboard Swamp, and there's a natural artesian well. It was just about dusk. And I'm just down there drinking and smoking a cigarette. He looks up and he sees what he thinks is a dead tree.
Oh my gosh.
He looked at it for a moment, and a car started coming by because there's a road that cuts right through it.
Yeah.
On a bridge, and the thing just looked up and walked into the woods. And this happened before Chris's sighting, and so you know, it's just vague glimpses. But there was a family of five people that were driving there in 1990, and something lunged at them. So there was another report in which a creature kind of lunged at the car, but all the others were basically distant sightings. One guy was a crop duster, and as he was taking off, he saw something moving down below, and he tried to circle back and just
oh wow.
But he saw it from the high vantage point. You know, Frank Mitchell, and that's another guy that I interviewed, you know, when I was doing my book. So you know, unfortunately, no other attacks, but still it's pretty spooky.
Oh, yeah.
Well, what do you, can we ask what you think the Lizard Man, what your thoughts are on what the Lizard Man actually is? Do you have...
You think it's a reptilian, or I think it was Lauren Coleman that might have said that one idea is that it's a Bigfoot creature that it's maybe got moss or algae kind of, you know, in its fur. You think it's more like a Bigfoot creature that's being misidentified as a reptilian, or do you think it could be a reptilian?
I kind of go more with Lauren's theory on that, and for a few reasons. One, if you start looking at the reports, I mean, the drawings of the lizard man show a tail and all this, and only a few people ever reported they thought they saw a tail. Most of the time, it was never a tail. No one said it was green. It was brownish. Most cases.
I'm just picturing green this whole time, but you never said green.
Right. Unfortunately, I mean, the media's version of it is a little more creature from the Black Lagoon.
Right.
The reality of it, and in some of the later sightings, people literally got a really close look, and they said they believed it had hair. They described it in more in terms of Sasquatch.
Now, okay.
You know, in my book, there was a lot of differences in some of the sightings. I thought, well, perhaps people were seeing different creatures. I mean, it doesn't mean just because you saw one thing in one area, it was always the same creature or same type.
Right.
So there could be a number of explanations. I mean, it was even, you know, some people said Christopher Davis was hoaxed. It was a farmer who was chasing him or whatever. You know, so who knows? I mean, it was a lot of hearsay, and there's always comes up in these cases. So I never was quite convinced it was a reptilian humanoid, because that is pretty hard to swallow. I mean, maybe if we're talking about aliens or something, maybe you could bring it. But as far as just anything that evolved, or a relic dinosaur that has a theropod that's somehow evolved to walk on two legs and be very anthropomorphic, human in form.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure about that.
Yeah.
But like in all my books, I just, these stories are so spooky and awesome.
That
unfortunately can't prove what these things are.
Yeah.
It is something that did happen, and real people reported, and it is an engaging story, I guess.
Well, what you're doing is good, because what you're doing and what we try to do is, like, you present these stories to the listening public or to your readers, and you let them make an informed decision. You know, you put the stories out there, you ask them to keep an open mind, you know, look at it from a scientific point of view, and let them kind of decide for themselves, you know, what, you know, if there's truth to any of these things.
Exactly. I think we all need to go through life with an open mind. You know, I'll be much happier.
Yeah.
But did you mention that Christopher, the man who was attacked in his car, he said he saw three fingers?
Yes.
So, am I recalling correctly, like in Boggy Creek, or some accounts where the Bigfoot is a little bit more aggressive, that the footprints are showing like three toes? So I'm wondering if it could be a Bigfoot, but it's confined in its area and maybe inbreeding, kind of like what they think with the Bigfoot, and maybe that's why it's aggressive. And I don't know, maybe that's why
or if it's living in swamps, I would think that would be why.
I think I remember it was Chester Moore that brought up the fact that if they are, you know, because they're contained to smaller areas, they are possibly inbreeding, and that would explain fewer digits and the more aggressive behavior. That's just,
right.
I remember him mentioning that, so that's probably what you're thinking.
Yeah. Do you think any of that has anything to do with it, or kind of coincidence?
Well, certainly the three-toe or three-finger motif comes up in all these swamp monster stories, which is odd, coincidental or happenstance, I'm not sure. But that's one of the theories about the Sasquatch three-toed tracks. That, I mean, certainly small populations, deformities could occur, and in those cases, it's proven, you know, by human deformity and things, that it can cause aggression. So
right.
They kind of match up and go hand in hand. And then you have the lizard man, who also allegedly has three-toed tracks, mm-hmm. three fingers, things like that. So it does bring up the possibilities of deformities and things like that. Honey Island swamp monster, mm-hmm. three toes.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a theme to this all throughout. Mm-hmm. These kind of swamp cryptids, so mm-hmm. I don't know, without a body or some better proof or more footprints, it's really impossible to make a definitive judgment. You can only just kind of throw all these theories out there and say, well, they all have merit, and certainly agree with Chester on those things.
Yeah, we would love for these things to be proven real at some point, but in the meantime, if we never find out in our lifetime, it's fun. You know, it's something we love to get into, and as I'm sure you're the same, you know, you grow up loving this sort of thing and just, you know, obsessing about it and wanting them to be real and wanting to find out more and wanting to, that's what prompted us to become such big campers and hikers. We want to be out there in hopes of hearing something or seeing something.
You want to believe that there's something more out there than has been discovered, you know, whether it's in space or in the woods or in the sea. That's just my take on things. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the TV shows that you've been on?
Sure. Yeah, so I mentioned...
Sorry.
I mentioned off and on. It's been cool to participate in some of the shows that are on now. There's so many of these cryptid-based TV shows. It's very popular, and certainly Finding Bigfoot on Animal Planet has been the pinnacle of Bigfoot television and watched by many, you know. I mean, it's hard to portray actual Bigfoot research on TV because a lot of it is very slow and boring, but it balances the line between solid research and interviewing people and going into the field. It's mm-hmm. the best of both worlds, I think. But I was fortunate to have done an episode of Finding Bigfoot, which they came down to Falcon, Arkansas, and all those guys are big fans of the legend of Boggy Creek. I mean, just about any big-time Bigfooter is into that. So it was great to be able to take them to that area and to go on the night investigation. And they did a great tribute to the legend of Boggy Creek. I mean, and I noticed that it brought it to a whole new generation of fans, young mm-hmm. Bigfooters and things who, you know, I have my pulse on that. I know a lot of DVDs were bought and a lot of books, you know, because people were newly interested in the story,
right.
Which was great, because I think it's a great movie, and it still translates well
to the
younger generation, and it's fun, so it was great. And Monsters and Mysteries in America, which is a show that's done two seasons now on Destination America, I was fortunate to be a part of several episodes, one of those being a Falk Monster, mm-hmm. where we got to reenact some of the newer sighting reports that had come to me. So, you know, I've taken these reports and found them to be quite credible.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and,
cool.
And to see them brought to life on TV was great. It was almost like seeing the new version of Legend of Boggy mm-hmm. Creek. I mean, it was like...
That's neat.
It was kind of surreal to watch this, and the cases that I brought forth and to participate in some way with the legend, so to speak. And, you know, we did a Lizard Man episode. I went out and they flew me out to Skateboard Swamp, and we shoot on location. I mean,
we do
our best to, you know, be accurate with these. And, you know, of course, it's television, so you gotta, play up the good stuff. But, but I mean, you know, they documented just what Christopher Davis said happened.
And
you know, interviewed some of the locals in Truesdale, and I was was there in Skateboard Swamp trying to provide my commentary as a million mosquitoes were buzzing my face. I mean, I was constantly like, okay, now where was I? Okay, pick up. They did a wonderful editing job, but if you watch the episode, I could see one mosquito sitting on my face.
Oh, gosh.
And anytime I'd say something really good, succinct, and what I thought was a great way to say what I wanted to say, and it's like, yeah, oh man, there's a mosquito right on my nose. So it's fun, you know, these are unscripted reality shows.
And yeah.
Certainly, I mean, you're in the swamps. I think, why did I specialize in swamp monsters?
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah. I love those environments. And, you know, I was a part of the Lake Worth Monster episode, and Lake Worth Monster is a local legend.
Mm-hmm.
Reports in 1969 out there at Lake Worth near Fort Worth where a creature was seen. People called it the Lake Worth Goat Man or the Scaly Goat Man, Lake Worth Monster. So it's cool that they actually did a story.
It is.
One of our more lesser known local.
Yeah, local.
Cryptids. Uh-huh. And it's cool to, you know, to be able to bring that to TV and kind of share that with others who probably never heard of Lake Worth Monster. You
know? Oh, yeah. It's really neat that... it's kind of like coming full circle. Like you said, you grew up watching the Boggy Creek Monster as a kid, and you probably never would have guessed that you would have left your mark on the Boggy Creek legend itself by, you know, later on writing a book and it getting out there and being such a, you know, a fan favorite. It won Best Cryptid Book of the Year. Is that right? In 2010, 2011 when it came out?
Yeah, both of my books in the last 2 years have gotten the Best Cryptid Book.
Yeah, that's... That's
both
amazing.
Both of them.
I knew I was getting to that one.
Yeah.
But it's neat that you've left your mark, you know, just growing up as a kid and watching it and obsessing about it and then being able to, like you said, reenact the news stories that you've brought to the public's attention. It must be very satisfying as a cryptozoologist and a fan.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't ever even imagine this.
I know.
I just sort of wrote a book about the subject I really like and... Yeah, to be a part of the legend of Boggy Creek in some way, because if you tell the whole story to date, I'm sort of in it now. And when I go to Falk, you know, when I first started, I didn't really know anybody up there. If I go there now, I can just stand on the street and people will drop by. You know, I think I've done a good job of telling the story and portraying it seriously. Telling a little bit of history about the area, and that's what I set out to do, and I think people appreciate a down-to-earth story, and I don't have an agenda, I just tell it. Like you said, the reader can decide for himself what they think, because you know it's a cool story, and so it's very surreal to be a part of this. When I was a kid, I never would have, watching that movie, I never would have thought that I would have been involved. And it was not even something I could go, when I grow up, I want to be part of
it. I'm going to be in that, that show or that
impossible
story.
It just happened, so it's very cool.
That's great.
Do you have any upcoming shows in the near future that you're planning to be part of?
Well, if you're in the Ohio area,
I'll
be at the Ohio Bigfoot Conference on April 26th, and that's one of the best conferences going out there. I mean, it's a great area. And attended by, you know, a lot of the top Bigfoot guys. It's my speakers, myself, Cliff Barrett from Finding Bigfoot, Bob Gimlin, Patterson Gimlin film.
He's such a cowboy.
Yeah, he's awesome. So, met him a few times. It's great to know those, you know, hang out with those guys. And then on the weekend of May, first weekend in May, I think, 3rd, 4th, and 5th, I guess the Texas Frightmare Weekend.
Oh, yeah. We'll be there probably.
Okay,
In Dallas. So that's, I mean, dude, the guest list of that has gotten insane. It's going to be a fantastic
event. It is. It always is. It's such a good event. And I guess they can keep up with you at your website, LyleBlackburn.com. Is that right?
LyleBlackburn.com. Give you links to my books, whatever flavor you desire, Amazon, my own store where you can get autographed copies, and a link. I've got a Falk Monster informational site, and all the links are there, so just hit LyleBlackburn.com, and it will open a world of wonder and spooky cryptids.
Yeah, there's I've been to your store and online, and
There's one item in particular I have my eye on, and that's the Boggy Creek statue. That is, have you seen this?
Mm-mm.
Oh, it's
no,
pretty
I have
epic.
Not.
It's pretty epic. It's based on your cover, is that correct?
Or it's actually what we tried to do with that is to imagine the creature from the original movie poster as if it was 3D, like, you know, it's silhouetted and shadowed on that. So in a way, here we are back to Ralph McQuarrie's vision of the Fountain Monster.
Yeah.
And so it's based on the original poster because I thought it was the most iconic version of it. So, and I was lucky to get a sculptor, Gene St. Gene. He's a hugely successful sculptor. He's done a lot of the toys you see, DC Direct, a lot of characters, Universal Monsters, Pumpkinhead, I mean, countless figures that I have in my house. Like, you did all these, you know?
That's awesome.
He sculpted it, so I have one over there in my booth if you want to look at it.
I'm definitely looking at it. Because I'm, you know, you see the pictures on it on the website, and I'm sure it's as good as those pictures are. It doesn't compare to seeing the thing in person.
Well, I think one of the, because you were bringing up the poster for Boggy Creek, I think that is one of my favorite just shots. Poster, you know, when you put in the DVD, you see it up there on your screen. I just love what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just creepy.
It's iconic, like you said.
You don't see really any detail at all, and it's kind of like, kind of got this gimp zombie type thing going on, so it just makes it look really creepy.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the DVD, it's got kind of the sounds whenever you leave it on the main menu. It's got the sounds going along with it, so it just really adds to it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's just that vibe, and I mean, it just shows you the power of Ralph McQuarrie. It's such a simple poster. I mean, it doesn't have a lot of pizzazz or stuff going on, but it's so effective, and, you know, 40-plus years later, it's still cool looking.
Yeah.
And it captures just enough of the mystery of that thing and just enough creepiness. It just works perfect. And
it does,
You know, it's I think modern movie makers should take a hint at that poster, you know. It's effective, and you don't have to have, you know, super detailed painting, just have an effective painting.
Right.
Yeah, the old movie poster is definitely a lost art. You know, nowadays it's all Photoshop, and not you don't see a whole lot of just painted paintings, you know, anymore for posters.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask you one last question before we kind of wrap it up. Are there any other cryptids that you are interested in investigating other than Bigfoot and
like, what would be
Lizard
the,
Man?
The next
others?
Challenge?
Next challenge, next adventure?
You know, there's Bigfoot is such a wide range that there's a lot. What I've done, I'm looking at is a lot of other regional sightings of creatures where they've given them a name, like, you know, like the Fountain Monster. I mean, essentially a Bigfoot creature, but localized names I'm real fascinated with. There's a lot of them in Texas. I mean, the Sabine thing, Polly M, Old Mossy Back.
That's a good one.
You know, there's just lists on and on, you know, Lake Worth Monster and things. So I like to look at all those cases, kind of see the parallels between those. For other cryptids, you know, I mean, you know, I like some of the lake monsters of the U.S. I mean, you know, but a lot of it depends. I do like to put boots on the ground and go to these places, so I have to work with what's in my proximity. So,
right.
Yeah.
You know, I think... I'm going to be going down to Honey Island Swamp.
Yeah, man.
I've been there once, but I'm going to be going down there again this spring to do some research. And,
nice.
So Honey Island Swamp Monster is very cool.
It is.
Oh, yeah.
We you know. That's another one we like to kind of dig around and find stuff out about.
We love that documentary. And I really think it's neat. It's really cool that you want to go to the actual place. You don't want to just talk about it. You don't want to just do research or read. You want to actually go. And, you know, I think a lot of people are like that, but some people aren't. And I really admire you for that.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people just want to rehash what they've heard elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I could get on Google and write a book. You know, a not very accurate book.
Exactly.
I look at the Wikipedia, you know, entries for Rock Monster and now the Lizard Man, and I had to go up there and correct whole bunch of it.
I'm sure.
Once I'd done the research, it was wrong. So,
but
Abraham Lincoln says everything on the internet is true. So.
I don't know, it's a paradox, but yeah, I mean, I have fun going out. I couldn't be a writer who just sat at home, like, writing. I have to actually go somewhere and do some stuff and, like, you know, paddle by a 14-foot alligator or something at night. I must have this experience, then it charges up the writing. I think it makes the books better. The feedback I get on the books is quite positive because they know I've been there and I've done my best to sort it out, and I can describe the area. I'm not just saying, well, this happened over here. So when I research cryptids, you know, it's going to require me going somewhere. It's a lot more to it than just, well, I like the Mothman. I'll write a story or whatever. You know, it's I need to have some personal experience in that to create a better book.
That's how it should be. Well, Lyle, again, thank you. We can't thank you enough for stopping in at GeekyCon and talking with us. Again, check out his website, LyleBlackburn.com. Definitely look into the books, The Beast of Boggy Creek and The Lizard Man, and the awesome Boggy Creek statue that's for sale, along with the other things that he's got. He's got T-shirts up there, posters. Check it out. Lyle's a good guy, and we appreciate everything that you're doing for cryptozoology. We really do.
Yeah, we do. Awesome job.
But, thank you.
Thanks.
And live from GeekyCon, this is Figments. And remember to ask yourself, are they real?
Or are they figments? That was supposed to be my part. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Figments is a production of EdMed Art Studios and hosted by the Jedi Cole Universe. You can find us at www.jedicole.com and www.eddiemedina.com. Thank you for listening, and keep searching for the unknown.